Hello, welcome to a very special edition of I'm Dying to Tell You. This is my very first inspired replay. I'm going to share an episode that was originally shared last year. This is an episode that is for everyone. It's about life, about love, about those intimate lessons that when you know you're going to die, you really, really want people to know, to understand, and to value after you're gone. In honor of the 25th anniversary of the American classic book, Tuesdays with Maury, I am resharing my conversation with author Mitch Albom. After this intro, I'm going to play the entire episode as it was recorded in 2021. If by chance you have never heard of Tuesdays with Maury, let me tell you real quick. The book is a result of the author, Mitch Albom, reconnecting with his college professor, who is dying from ALS. But while the book isn't about ALS, his professor, Maury Shorts, kind of takes Mitch on as his very last lesson. He wants to pass on to him what he has learned in his long, full life about what's important, specifically how to live, really live this tough life. I loved hearing more about Maury and from Mitch himself, who is an incredible giving person. And I get excited every time I have the chance to share this conversation, Mitch Albom, and the book Tuesdays with Maury. In this inspired replay, you're going to hear how Mitch Albom even reconnected with his college professor after, I think it was 16 years, how they even got together again. You will hear about how this book was not even supposed to reach you and I. You will, of course, hear what life lessons Maury wanted Mitch to know and everyone else to know before he died. And as a bonus, you're going to hear Mitch talk about his book, The Stranger in the Lifeboat. If you haven't read it yet, you can order that. And then also order the 25th edition of Tuesdays with Maury. Because what Mitch has done is that he wrote a new afterword to celebrate the 25th anniversary. And in that, he shares the letter that he wrote to the publisher, kind of telling him about these conversations that he was having with Maury and about this idea that he had for the book. And I think he said that was the first time that he has shared that letter. So it should be something that you have never seen before. And I just want to continue to bless people with this book. And so if you haven't read Tuesdays with Maury, go to my Instagram at I'm Dying to Tell You Podcast. And I will be giving away some copies of the 25th edition. So you can read it or you can gift it to someone that hasn't read it yet. Again, that's on Instagram at I'm Dying to Tell You Podcast. I'm going to go ahead and say thank you for listening to this episode. I won't be coming on at the end. I'm going to let the original episode play all the way through. Okay, let's go to this inspired replay, my conversation with Mitch Albom that aired October 2021. We'll start at the very beginning. Here you go.
Hey, I'm Paul.
And I'm Christian.
Welcome to I'm Dying to Tell You. Inspiration shared by our mom, who is dying from ALS.
There is no cure for our mom, or anyone else with ALS. But right now, she's on a mission to find and share stories of inspiration.
Coming to you from Cincinnati, Ohio, we're happy to introduce the one lady we both love since the first day we laid eyes on her. The queen of the Queen City, our mom, your host, Lori.
Hello, I'm Lauren Carey, and welcome to my podcast, I'm Dying to Tell You. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I think you're going to be really happy that you did. I'm just so grateful and so very excited to not only share my guest, but also his beautiful message for all of us. Okay, so my guest is a best-selling author, screenwriter, playwright, broadcaster, and nationally syndicated columnist. He has written 7 number one New York Times bestsellers, and his books collectively have sold more than 40 million in 47 languages worldwide. He is the author of Tuesdays with Maury, the best-selling memoir of all time. This guy inspires me not only through his work, but also with his giving heart. He has founded 9 charities in Detroit, Michigan, and also operates an orphanage in Haiti. He lives in Michigan with his wife, Janine. I'm super happy to introduce Mitch Albom. Let's get to our chat. When I decided to do this podcast, I made a list of those who had already inspired me, those who had given me something to fuel my fight, to keep living and push forward despite living with a terminal illness and being given limited time. And at the top of my list, Mitch Albom, Maury Schwartz. So I am just so grateful to catch up with you.
I'm happy to do it.
Okay. I reread the book Tuesdays with Maury after I was diagnosed with ALS. And every word, every message was more amplified and much more relatable. I know it's safe to say that everyone in our ALS community has a special connection with Maury and the book itself, and a deep appreciation for the lessons that he shared. So thank you for doing it. And thank you for continuing to talk about Maury in so many ways, including your podcast, Tuesday People, and just keeping his spirit alive.
You're more than welcome. Thank you for the kind words.
Okay. For anyone that might not know about Tuesdays with Maury, can you take us back to the 70s, your college years? Tell us how you even found Maury Schwartz.
Sure. So Maury Schwartz was really one of the first professors I had when I started college, because I met him on the first day of college in 1975. I was at Brandeis University just outside of Boston. I had signed up for his class. It was an introduction to sociology of some kind. And I remember when I walked into his class, I looked in the room and there were only like 9 kids in the room. And being a typical freshman, I immediately sized it up and said, I don't want to be in this class. This is too small. Yeah. If I cut it, they'll know I'm not here. So I was actually leaving the class to go drop the class at the registrar's office. I was kind of halfway out the door and down the hall when Maury began to call roll. And, you know, one of the problems when your last name begins with A is that you can't get out of a room fast enough. And so he called out Mitchell Album. And so I kind of, out of guilt, sort of slid back in. Now, I suppose, in looking back on it, I could have kept going because he wouldn't have known it was me. And I could have just gone and dropped the class. And I promise you, if I did that, I would never be talking to you. And I would never have had the life that I've had. And so I always look back on that, and on such a small little thing, you know, your whole life changes. And I went back into the room and raised my hand and said, here. And he said, okay, is it Mitch or Mitchell? Which do you prefer? And, you know, that doesn't mean anything, I'm sure, to most people who are listening to you. But for me, you know, it was a big deal because I have one of those names that Mitch, Mitchie, Mitchell, whatever. And so I said, well, Mitch, my friends call me Mitch. And he said, all right, Mitch it is. And Mitch, and I said, yeah, I hope one day you'll think of me as your friend. That was what he said to me. And so I knew that I couldn't cut the class at that point. But that began a really amazing relationship that he and I had. I took every class that he offered. I majored in sociology as a result of him. I probably had 8 different classes with him. I did my honors thesis with him. And we spent a lot of time on campus walking around together, sitting under trees, eating a lunch. You know, he was more like an uncle to me, and he guided me as I was very young when I was in college. And I think I was looking for a parent figure who would approve of me, you know, and he was that. And on graduation day, I got him a little briefcase, I remember, as a present. I'd never bought a present for a teacher, and I didn't have any money, so it must have been the cheapest briefcase in the world. But he acted like it was a brick of gold, and he turned it around every which way, and he started to cry a little bit. And he said, Mitch, you're one of the good ones. Promise me you'll stay in touch. And I said, okay, I will. He said, no, promise. I said, okay, I promise. Say it in a sentence. Okay, I promise I'll stay in touch. I promise I'll stay in touch. And then I graduated and I went off into the world to do sports writing and then broadcasting and then television. And I got bigger and bigger and more well known and made more and more money. And I proceeded to break that promise every day and week and month and year for 16 years. I was just busy being selfishly absorbed and ambitious. And I never got back in touch with him. Until one night, 16 years after I graduated, I happened to be flipping the channels on the TV and came upon the Nightline program by Ted Koppel. And I did a double take because there on the screen was a thin, white-haired version of my old professor, Maury Schwartz, only he was talking to Ted Koppel about what it was like to die from ALS. And it was only through that chance flipping of the remote control that I discovered that this man who had meant so much to me now only had a few months left to live. And I called him up thinking I would have one phone call with him. That was it, just one phone call. And one phone call turned into a visit. One visit turned into another visit. Another visit turned into another visit, another visit every Tuesday. And pretty soon I was going there every Tuesday for all the Tuesdays that he had left in his life. And we did a last class together in kind of what's important in life once you really recognize that, you know, it might be coming to an end and how to put that into perspective and how to use that now when we're young enough and healthy enough to do something about it. And ultimately, those lessons, which I put together in a book to pay his medical bills, it wasn't supposed to be a book that found its way to you. It was supposed to be some tiny little book that only sold copies to me and his family. But somehow it became much bigger than anybody anticipated. And that became Tuesdays with Maury.
Wow. Do you ever stop and think about what was that you happened to be in front of the TV right at that time?
Yeah, all the time. And I think it's like I find with all the rest of my life and the really important things that have happened in it. There's like something guiding me, some force that's putting me in these positions. They're not, you know, it's not lifting my hands and my feet and forcing me to walk someplace or whatever, but it's putting these things in front of me that are challenging me to pursue them, and as a result, become a better person. And most of the best things in my life have kind of been accidents that have happened. And then it's like, well, what are you going to do with that accident? And, you know, the paths that I've chosen, the things that I've taken, chosen to do have turned out to be very enriching.
Yeah. Well, I would say that you're a good listener and you have a heart that is willing to evaluate and dig into what you hear. I feel like we don't do that enough. You know, we kind of just go about like, but I feel like you have this ability to be open to what does it mean? And look where it has led you today.
Well, I think most storytellers, and that's all I consider myself to be, is just a storyteller. I don't have much talent outside of that, but I have some talent in that world. I think most storytellers listen by, you know, almost definition. And when I was a little kid, I used to be the one who sat at the table when the adults would tell all the old war stories or the old stories of the family. My peers, my brothers and sisters or cousins or whatever, they would all run away and go play. And I would just sit there and watch the way one uncle or an aunt could command the table and how another one couldn't because they didn't know how to tell a story well, you know, how to do the voices of the story. And, you know, that's where you learn to become a writer, I think, is at those dinner tables when you're a kid or on the porches in your neighborhood or hanging around the schoolyard, you know, listening. Before you can write a story, you have to hear stories. And and I heard a lot of them.
Yeah, I love that. So I've been living with ALS for 17 years, and I feel like living with a terminal illness that has a set time frame assigned to it, you know, originally it was 2 to 5 years, any limited amount of time, it is kind of a gift in that you can see things differently and you can see things more clearly. And it seems like Maury gave you some of that gift to see things more clearly. Would you agree with that? And what is, you know, what do you think he was able to see during his time? And then what lesson that was most valuable to you did he pass along?
Well, those are three pretty big questions in and of themselves. So I'll try to answer one at a time, but I might, by the time I answer the first one, I may have forgotten the second one. So you,
I got you. Okay.
So yes, I do think that the clarity that you're referring to, that you clearly have, that he had, I've seen it now in many walks of life, not just ALS.
Yeah.
You know, there are many other diseases where they give you a time frame, even, you know, artificial time frames like, you know, retirement. Or when someplace you work at is closing, you know, or you're finishing school. All these things are sort of endings and passages to something else.
Yeah.
And they give you perspective. You know, when you're about to graduate college in your last 2 months, you suddenly start to appreciate what it was like to be a freshman and what it's like to be in a dorm and how cool it is and fun to just have your friends around and all you really have to do is study and hang out with your friends. But you never thought about that when you were a freshman or sophomore, but suddenly when it's about to be taken away from you, you say, I don't want to go. I want to do a fifth year of college, you know, and that only hits, like you say, because suddenly the time frame is closing down on you. And the same thing with the job. If your place is going out of business, suddenly all the office politics, all the hard work, all the things that, you know, might have been distasteful to you during the time that you were there, you forget all that and you suddenly lament, you know, how much you're going to miss the place and, you know, miss coming in and miss seeing everybody. And this goes on throughout life. And I don't think it's any different when we get towards the end of our life or we get a prognosis that tells us that we're not going to have a long period of time. And I think that clarity, if you're older, is really worth something because it enables you to prioritize what's important and what is not, and what you want to waste your time on and what you don't. And And you find that a lot of things that you spent so much time on, you have no interest in now and no tolerance for. And you wonder why you couldn't dismiss them before so easily, and now you can. Why you couldn't see that this just doesn't matter, and now it's so clear that it doesn't matter. And so it's a really valuable gift, as you say, that seems to be reserved only for people who are handed these types of circumstances. Now, my goal with Tuesdays with Maury as a book, when I finally sat down to, you know, try to write his book, but even before that, when I started to come visit Maury again and again, remember, I didn't go there to write a book. I just went there to see him because I felt I was getting something out of it. Every time I went back, I felt like instead of being a 37-year-old, overly ambitious type A personality, I was like a student again. And I was sitting in one of those little small desk chairs, you know, where you always had to slide in, and there was always graffiti from the person who had the class before you. And I was a student again, and I was open to learning what Maury had to say. And I liked myself better that way. Mm-hmm. And so I saw that he had something that could really help me in my current life, even though then I was only 37 and I was perfectly healthy. I had no reason to think my life might be shortened or nothing was threatening me, but I saw the value of what he had. And I wanted to get that for myself, to be able to say, this matters, this doesn't matter. You think this matters, but when you get to the end, it's not going to matter. And apply that to my life now and not waste all that time on things that were unimportant. But when I wrote the book, I really tried to express that. That, I think, was kind of the overwhelming message that I was trying to get across in there. It wasn't about me or my life. It was about, look, here's what this brilliant older man who was on limited time had to say once he got one foot in the other world, once he was looking over the moon, once he was sort of seeing heaven ahead, but Earth in the rear view. He was able to kind of say, okay, take it from me. Trust me. As he always would say, you will get to where I am. You don't think you will, but you will. Maybe not with ALS, maybe not with something. You'll be at this moment. Mm-hmm. Learn what I have to learn. So I think that's a precious, precious gift.
Yeah. And so what do you think, when he had one foot in, one foot out, what do you think he learned most during that time for himself?
That love is the most important currency. And that giving is the most important action. Those two things. Love is the most important currency. Giving is the most important action. He would often quote, I think it was Stephen Levine, I can't remember, but love is the only rational act. He would love to say that over and over again. Love is the only rational act, meaning everything else really doesn't make a lot of sense. But love, sharing love, giving love, receiving love, that's the only act that makes sense. Everything else is kind of like, what are we bothering for? And giving is living is probably the biggest message that I have employed from Maury in my own life. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the other stuff about family that we talked about, I was always close with my family, and a lot of stuff about, you know, money not being the means to all things. I had never really believed that. I've been broke and I've been wealthy, and, neither one did I aspire to or really all that much care about. But the giving is living thing, you know, I had been taking much more in the earlier part of my life, not in an abusive way. I don't think I was a terrible person, but I just, you know, I was taking advantage of opportunities, taking the hours that I was given to work, taking the weekends that I was given to work, given a choice between writing another article or doing another TV show or doing another radio show and going and doing something charity wise. It wasn't even a choice. I wasn't even aware of the charity things that were out there to do because I didn't spend time enough to even look for them.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you a funny story about where the giving and living lesson came from. I would watch these other people would come visit Maury on the days that, you know, when I was there. Most of the time they didn't come on Tuesdays because that was kind of reserved for me, but sometimes they would. And a lot of these people like were only visiting once, and they didn't know like how to deal with somebody who had been diagnosed with a terminal illness. They were kind of nervous, and they would bring photographs or stuff from their kids or whatever. They'd have like a game plan so that they would be upbeat. You know, they want to be down in any way. So they would come in, you know, trying to cheer him up. And they would go into the office and the door would close. And they'd come out an hour later and they'd be crying. But they would be crying about like their job or their love life or their divorce or their problems, whatever. And they would say, well, I don't know. I went in there to try to cheer him up. But after about 5 minutes of doing that, he started asking me questions. And so I started answering. Then he started asking me more questions. Then he started really asking me questions. And I really opened up and I started crying. And, you know, I wanted to try to comfort him, but I ended up being comforted by him. He was like their therapist.
Yeah.
So I watched this happen so many times that I finally said, I went into him on Tuesday, said, I don't understand. Like, if ever anyone had finally earned the right to say, let's not talk about your problems, let's talk about my problems, it would be you. You know, you've hit the mother load of sympathy here, you know? Why don't you just take advantage of it? And he looked at me very strangely, as if I was suggesting like I should have two heads or something. And he said, Mitch, why would I ever take from people like that? Taking just makes me feel like I'm dying. Giving makes me feel like I'm living.
Oh, I love that.
And it's a profound sentence. And I always say it rhymes, so it's easy to remember.
Yeah.
Giving makes you feel like you're living. And it's proven to me to be so true that all the things that you take, all the things you buy, they never make you feel alive for long. They don't last. The new car smell always fades.
Yeah.
But giving makes you get that tingle in your stomach when you do something for somebody. You help a child, you help somebody elderly, you help a poor person who doesn't have a chance in whatever way you do. And that lasts so long and you feel vitalized. And even if you yourself are hurting, physically hurting, fatigued, that feeling of giving, and when somebody says thank you, you know, thank you for what you just did, it's everything. And and that's such a simple thing to learn in life. And it's definitely not something we should wait till the end of our days to suddenly stumble upon.
Right.
And so that to me is the most profound, impactful thing that Maury taught me, that I really did change my life around. And if you know me now, you know, versus then, 60% of my week, 70% of my week is charity stuff. Is just the orphanage that I operate in Haiti, or the 9 charities I have in Detroit. And I don't say that for any recognition or anything. I just say that it makes me feel alive. It's much better than the taking part.
I'm so glad that you said that, because the first thing that came to my mind was the fact that you are a giver. I was wondering what you felt at the time. Did you realize that he was giving of himself to you, and that he was investing in you so very much at the time? Which is exactly what you do through all of your work in Detroit and Haiti. And, you know, hopefully another time we can talk about that, because I think it's so amazing. But that's what you do. You pour love and worth into people. And were you realizing that?
I can kind of understand it now, having, as you say, kind of doing more of it myself, in that I think it made Maury feel alive. You know, a lot of the people who came to visit him, they were already pretty enlightened. You know, that's why they were his friends. They wouldn't have been if they weren't. They kind of already had his worldview. They kind of already understood a lot of the things that he was saying. And they had been friends of his for a long time. But I was kind of a wayward student, you know. I was the duckling that kind of walked away from the pack of that he usually had. I hadn't stayed in touch with him. I hadn't followed his suggestions. I hadn't done any of that. And I think, and I wish I could ask him this, but I, you know, I kind of got the sense from talking to him that he told me enough times that I was kind of a challenge. In a certain way, and a challenge that now that he wasn't teaching anymore, he missed. I think it was a challenge that he got every semester when he was teaching, because there'd always be some idiot like me in his class that he could, you know, transform. But now that he wasn't teaching anymore, all of a sudden here came this like one student and a wayward student at that. And he was able to turn me around. And I think it made him feel needed and vibrant and contributing. And of course he did. He turned me around greatly. And so, yeah, there was something in it for Maury, not selfishly in it, but something in it internally, that feeling of giving, that I think he came alive because his wife, Charlotte, would tell me, like, he's not doing well on this Monday. I don't know if he's going to be up for visiting with you. He's really had a hard time. And then Tuesday would come and he'd be great. He would rally, you know.
Yeah.
That was always the word that we would say. He always rallied on Tuesdays.
Aww.
I think it's because he wanted to have that effect. He wanted to feel like he was still doing something. And so yeah. I think he got something out of it too.
Yeah. When you have a fatal disease without a cure, you think about time. Think about time a lot. And I'm just going to read real quick a quote from Maury in the book. He says, what gives you satisfaction is offering others what you have to give, your time, your concern, like to lonely people who just want companionship. When I give them my time, when I can make someone smile after they were feeling sad, it is as close to healthy as I ever feel.
Yeah, that's a multi-word way of saying giving is living.
Yeah. I love that so much.
Yeah.
Okay. Tuesdays created a conversation about death and dying. And Maury was so open about dying, from his discussion group to your weekly heartfelt meetings, and then even his living funeral, which I love. What was the most important lesson that he shared about dying?
Well, I think he summed it up by quoting someone else, and that was, death ends a life, but not a relationship. And I puzzled with that a lot, that lesson, death ends a life, but not a relationship. Well, but it does, I say, you know, it does end the relationship, because, you know, you can't do the same things that you did. But what Maury meant by that was kind of summed up in the last thing that he said to me, which was the last visit that I had with him. And he wanted me to hold his hand. He was in bed. And that's kind of how I knew that we were at the end, even though, you know, nobody said he's going to die tomorrow, but it ended up, he did pass away 2 days later, because he would always insist on being taken out and put in his office. You know, he would say, when you're in bed, you're dead. And he didn't want to be in bed. And on this particular Tuesday, you know, I guess it was too hard for them to lift him. He was too tired. So he was in bed, and I was sitting next to him in bed holding his hand. And he said, I want to ask you a favor. And I said, okay. And he said, after I'm dead, I want you to come visit me at my grave. So I said, well, okay. You know, I was going to do that anyhow. And he said, well, not the way that everybody else does it. You know, don't come and get out of the car and leave the engine running and just come over and put down some flowers and then get back in the car and drive away. I want you to come when you have some time and bring a blanket and bring some sandwiches. And I want you to talk to me about life, about the Red Sox, about whatever's going on in the world. And I said, wait a minute, you want me to come to a cemetery and have a picnic at your tombstone and talk to the air? And he said, yes, just like we're talking now. And I said to him, well, Maury, it's not going to be like we're talking now, because let's face it, you're not going to be able to talk back. And he looked at me as if I were being very naive. And he said, well, Mitch, I'll make you a deal. After I'm dead, you talk, I'll listen. You know, I laugh too, obviously, it's funny. But in that sentence is pretty much everything that Maury was trying to teach me, and what I actually was trying to teach whoever read Tuesdays with Maury, and is the answer to the question that you posed, which was the thing that he taught me most about death, is that it's not the end. If you have invested time while you are living, If you have invested time doing all those things you just said, listening, sharing of yourself, being compassionate, giving of yourself to other people, if that's how you spend your time, then when you're gone, you're not 100% gone. You live on inside the heads and hearts of everyone you touch. Yeah. And that's why they can talk to you after they're gone, not because some kind of magic or ghosts or seances or stuff like that, but because you spend time putting yourself inside them. I always liken it to a penny in a piggy bank. When you take a penny and you put it inside a piggy bank, for all intents and purposes, it's gone, right? It's dead and gone. You can't, you're never going to get it back. Yeah. You're never going to see it again. You don't know where you can't, you know, where did it go? You don't see it. It's not there. But if you take the piggy bank and you shake it next to your ear, then there it is, right? And that's what memories are like. And they're like the shaken piggy bank. And if people made these great memories with you and made you feel a certain way when they were around or whatever, then when they're gone, you can still feel that. And you can still hear their voice talking to you, and you can still hear them guiding you. Just like I can hear my mother and father saying to me, don't do that, you know, oh, no, 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 you don't do that. That's wrong. Or, you know, or yeah, it might be tempting, but that's not who you are. Or I hear their voices all the time. And so in that way, you know, they're still alive to me. And that's what I hold on to. That's how I cherish people who are gone. I cherish the good memories that I have. I forever look at pictures to be reminded of the moments. I have some videos, got my mother to tell the whole family story, you know, from as far back as she could remember it, who came over from as immigrants, and then who had which baby, and who the grandparents and the uncles and all. And I watch that all the time just to be sort of reminded of who I am and where I came from. And, you know, when I watch that video, it's like she's there. And so that's part of that death ends a life, but not a relationship. And I think that that's the best weapon that you can have against the otherwise sadness and grief and horrible, you know, things that people go through when they lose a loved one.
Yeah. And right next to me, you can't see it, but there's a wall here, angel wings on the top, and then the wall is covered with pictures of me with ALS brothers and sisters that I've lost with a typical 2 to 5 years.
Yeah.
And I've been here 17. I've lost a lot. And some of them, I've been there at the final breath. And we try to talk about them. It's uncomfortable for a lot of people. And so I love, love, love through your podcast, Tuesday People, that you talk about Maury. You share his voice. And I think we need to do more of that. And people need to realize it isn't hurtful and it isn't uncomfortable, but that it is a part of who we are. And we want to say their name and we want to talk about them. So thank you for doing that. Okay. I want to go to your new book. I want to go to this book. They sent it to me and I read it. Okay. I sat down in this chair and I'm like, okay, I'm just going to start. And then I'm going to go over here on the couch and I'm going to get comfortable and I'm going to get something to drink and I'm going to read it. Well, I sat here and then I finished the book. It was so good. But I don't want to say too much because I don't want to give anything away. I was like yelling at the book, like, do something, you know? And then I'm like, what? So I want you to tell me about your new book that you have coming out on Tuesday, November 2nd.
Well, thank you for that. Thank you for reading it. And that it held you in the chair. It is a short book, so you can get through it pretty quickly. So the book basically begins when a raft washes up on the shore of a Caribbean island with nobody in it. And the police inspector discovers a notebook inside of it. And it turns out that this raft is from a luxury yacht that was owned by like one of the richest people in the world and that had exploded and supposedly killed everybody on board a year earlier. And now all of a sudden this notebook shows up and this raft shows up and there's nobody in it. And inside this notebook is an account of one passenger and what happened after the boat blew up. So it turns out that there were 10 people who survived this terrible explosion, including the owner of the boat, one of the richest people in the world, and a number of his very rich guests. And then the other half of the boat are workers on the boat who took care of the guests. So already you have kind of an interesting collection of people. And these 10 people are out there for several days and nobody comes looking for them. There's no airplanes, there's no helicopters, there's no other boats. And so they're realizing they're not going to be found. They're running out of food, they're running out of water. And suddenly, out in the middle of the ocean, they see this body floating and someone is alive. And they get to him and they pull him into the boat. He's just this young guy, very average looking, nothing special, a little chubby. And they ask him a bunch of questions like, you know, what happened? Where are you from? And he doesn't answer. He doesn't say anything. And finally, one of the women passengers says, well, thank the Lord we found you. And he says, I am the Lord. And that's the kind of premise of the setup of the book. And everything that goes from there as we follow this notebook explains what happens on the boat when they say, well, wait a minute, you say you're God. What are you doing here? And he says, well, haven't you been calling me? You know, and then they say, well, so you're here to save us? And he says, well, I can only save you if everybody in this boat believes I am who I say I am at the same time. And what ensues is, you know, day after day of them trying to survive, and some of them believe in him, but some of them don't. And things that look like miracles happen, but then they're kind of, maybe they're not really. And when they ask him to do certain things, he doesn't. He doesn't always say yes. And he certainly doesn't look like what they think God would look like. He certainly doesn't act like they think God would act. And it's a, you know, a parable, but an adventure story about what happens if we ask for help and help arrives, but it's not what we expected. It's not what we thought it would be. Are we still going to accept it? Are we still going to believe in it? And, you know, the bigger picture message of it is sometimes things happen that ultimately make you better and are what you need. But at the time, you would never recognize it. Just like the Rolling Stones saying, you know, you can't always get what you want, but if you try, sometimes you get what you need. And and that was kind of the principle behind it. So it's a very fast moving story, like you say. Very brisk, like adventure paced kind of thing. And it was fun to write about being adrift in the ocean. I never want that to happen to me ever.
No.
I'm scared to death of it. But I did study up a lot on it, and it's a great setting for a book. And it has some very interesting lessons about faith and belief and, you know, acceptance of how things are or what things can be made different.
Thanks for being so awesome and opening up our hearts and conversations about such meaningful topics. I think right now everyone is reevaluating and checking out, are they living purposefully and what's enhancing their life? So I think this comes at a good time. It's kind of a fun way to evaluate that.
Thank you.
Okay. At the end of every podcast episode, I ask my guest, what are you dying to tell us?
Well, I'm going to make this a little more personal than a general philosophy. Just because of where we are right now. I'm dying to tell you and everybody else that there is a country just an hour and 15 minutes off of our shores that I go to every month for the last 12 years that desperately needs our help. I'm talking about Haiti. It's a place where I have an orphanage and I have 53 children that I raised there who are the light of my life. And they are brilliant, wonderful, joyous kids who have been abandoned, left to die in the woods, in some cases left at malnutrition clinics or tuberculosis clinics with nobody coming back for them for years. Kids who don't know their own names, don't have birth certificates that we take in, and they're thriving and they're loving and they're smart. And they're funny, and they live in a country that is the second poorest country in the world, the poorest on this side of the world, and right now is under absolute siege by gangs who have basically taken over the streets to the point that nobody goes outside for fear of being kidnapped. And I don't know when the podcast that we're doing will be airing, but when we're talking right now, it's in the immediate aftermath of 17 missionaries who were kidnapped right after they visited an orphanage, not unlike ours, And they were accosted by a group of men on motorcycles and cars with guns, and they came out and they took over their bus. And now they're being held for a ridiculous amount of money, ransom, because this is a way that these gang members can get money. And but they don't just kidnap Americans or missionaries, where most of the time they just kidnap innocent Haitians who don't have a dime to their name. And they kidnap them and they tell their families, if you don't go sell your refrigerator and give us the money you get for it, we'll kill this person. Nobody should have to live under that kind of terror. And if the United States could get involved there, send a small military force or governing force, or the United Nations do the same. These gangs, you know, they're not that big. They're not that tough. They're just operating and taking advantage of a weakened country that saw its president assassinated and then had an earthquake and its economy is in ruins and just doesn't have the means to fight back. And these gangs are taking advantage of it. So people could try to implore whoever it is in their world to take on Haiti and help Haiti. They deserve it. It's our immediate neighbor. We occupied Haiti for nearly 20 years, from 1915 to 1934. We helped write their constitution. And so we are vested in that country, and we should be helping it. And I'm dying to tell people about that, and I hope that they listen.
Thank you so much. Where can we go to help, and what can we do specifically?
My orphanage, and that, if you want to just find out more about the situation, is havefaithhaiti.org. Havefaithhaiti.org. And that's a jumping off point. You can see the things that I've written about it. You can see other connected places and things that people do. And, you know, and then just implore your elected officials to, hey, you know, do something about Haiti. It makes a big deal if you send an email or a phone call to your congressperson or senator, just a simple line like that. Hey, you know, I don't want to see Haiti fall into the hands of gangs permanently. Please encourage the president to send down some kind of force.
Well, I think our community is up for that. I know those of us with ALS, we're used to that. Yep. Continuously reaching out to get access for drugs and everything else. So we aren't shy, and we'll all do what we can. Yeah. So to my listeners, I know I can count on you for that. And I will be putting links in the show notes on Facebook and the website, both at I'm Dying to Tell You Podcast, to go directly to MitchAlbum.com. And then you can read about the orphanage and what's going on there, along with a lot of information about his work and other great things that he does. So, yeah. So maybe I can have you on again someday to talk more about that, about Chica, about your family, about your 53 children. So much. I just can't thank you enough for all that you do, all that you've done, all that you're going to continue to do to make this world a better place and to inspire me and so many others. So,
well, you've inspired me before I even did your podcast. I already had great admiration for you, and I think what you're doing is great. And I support you in what you're doing and salute you for the positive energy that you're putting out there and the way that you're embodying everything that Maury talked about. And I know that he and you are kindred spirits. And I mean that more in the heart than just in the diagnosis. And so I'm happy to talk to you and look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you so much. If you're ever in Cincinnati, we can go to Skyline together.
Okay, there you go.
Great. Well, thank you so much. You really made my day, and continue to be blessed. And thank you so much. I appreciate it. Okay.
Talk to you soon. Best of luck.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye. Oh, Maury Schwartz. He's got to be smiling right now, realizing the impact he's had on Mitch and his life and his character, and just to witness how his beautiful words and outlook have inspired us all. Thanks again, Mitch, for this chat. I really appreciate it. All right, so I know I mentioned a few things, and just know you can go to the show notes on my website and the Facebook page, both at I'm Dying to Tell You Podcast, to get the links to the book and to Mitch's website, to read what Mitch is writing about what's going on in Haiti right now, how you can help, and so much more. if you liked this episode, and I really hope that you did. If it's in your heart, please give this podcast a 5-star rating and a note, a review on Apple Podcasts. Share with us your experience with Tuesdays with Maury, his life lessons, and how they've helped your perspective. If you want to follow me, I am pretty much everywhere on social media at I'm Dying to Tell You Podcast, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. I release new episodes of inspiration on Even Tuesdays. That's the 2nd and 4th Tuesday of each month. Also, I do recommend Mitch's new book coming out on November 2nd, The Stranger in the Lifeboat. I think you'll really enjoy it. Thank you so much for being here. And until next time, know you are loved and not alone. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to Our Mom. Make sure to visit her website at imdyingtotellyoupodcast.com, where you'll find photos and show notes about this episode. If you liked this show, please subscribe to the podcast and share it with a friend. Thank you.